From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So what the election judges were doing, they were taking the ballots and writing in the name of the writing candidate after the election had already closed. And they caught them doing that.
Today, the story of a Texas attorney whose election was stolen and what he did about it. Also, with the presidential race in the hands of the Supreme Court, we'll look at the legal developments of the past few days. And as members of Congress, the U.S. Trade Representative and labor groups condemn the Pentagon for buying apparel for a Nicaraguan sweatshop, we'll talk with a man who's led the campaign to expose the company. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Mexican President Vicente Fox agreed yesterday to meet the conditions laid out by Zapatista rebels from Chiapas to reopen a dialogue on peace. The promise came just a day after Zapatista subcommander Marcos broke a long silence and announced the Zapatistas would return to peace talks if the government enacts an Indian rights bill, releases imprisoned Zapatista sympathizers, and withdraws the army from positions in Zapatista strongholds. And this news nationally, the Pentagon has come under fire from members of Congress and drawn a stern letter from the Office of the U.S. Trade Representatives for obtaining large quantities of clothing from a Nicaraguan sweatshop. The factory, owned by Chentex, is a major human and worker rights violator. This, according to the National Labor Committee. We're joined right now by Charlie Kernighan, who heads that group based in New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Charlie Kernighan.
Oh, I bet that was...
Charlie Kernighan, are you there?
I bet it was.
Charlie, are you there?
Of course, yes, I'm here.
Charlie, can you tell us about this latest development that you've exposed, the Army buying from this sweatshop, and who owns it?
Well, you know, for some time now, we've been looking at this Taiwanese-owned sweatshop in Nicaragua called Chentex, and we were seeing shipments of clothing, huge shipments of clothing, going from Chentex in Nicaragua to a group in Waco, Texas, which identified itself by AAFES. And we figured, well, this is just another company using some sort of pseudonym code so we can't trace them. And we kept seeing these shipments. Now, this was coming out of a factory in Nicaragua, Chentex, where 700 workers were fired because they sought an 8-cent wage increase. They were fired. They were blacklisted. 11 union leaders were charged with trumped-up criminal charges, which could land them in prison for 14 to 20 years, illicit association to commit a crime, impeding free commerce, and all the rest of it. This was a place that's been surrounded by barbed wire and surveillance cameras that resembles a prison. And lo and behold, the organization, the AAFES, turns out to be the Army Air Force Exchange Service. So what we find out now is that the U.S. military, through the Army and Air Force Exchange Services, has been purchasing tons and tons of clothing made in this Chentex factory in Nicaragua at the very moment that workers are being cut down, fired, thrown out into the street, blacklisted, stripped of their rights, paid starvation wages, them and their families living in misery. Turns out that the Army and Air Force Exchange Service is actually one of the largest retailers in the world. You're talking about 1,423 retail outlets on military bases all around the world, 50,000 employees, $7.3 billion in sales, 8.7 million customers, $342 million profit, 13,000 contractors around the world, who would have multiple subcontractors. In other words, the U.S. military, which is subsidized, of course, by U.S. taxpayers' money, is one of the major sweatshop abusers in the world. What we've uncovered here is really just the tip of the iceberg.
Now, Charlie Kernighan, Fred Bloom of the Army and Air Force Exchange Service was quoted in the New York Times yesterday, saying that in light of the many criticisms of Chentex, the Exchange Service sent officials to Nicaragua to examine the Chentex operation, and he said, our representative who went there found no problems.
That's just, stunning, because when Congressman Sherrod Brown went to Nicaragua, he had no trouble meeting with hundreds of the workers who were fired. He had no trouble going into the free trade zone and seeing the barbed wire and the surveillance cameras. He had no trouble seeing the armed guards with the sawed-off shotguns and the Magnum pistols. He had no trouble going to workers' homes and seeing Chentek's workers living in dirt floor huts, raising their children on coffee and sugar water because they can't afford milk. He had no problems interviewing workers who said, in that factory, they treat you like an animal. He had no trouble reviewing pay stubs. Neither did Bishop Thomas Gummelton of Detroit, Roman Catholic bishop. In other words, this was just another one of those phony corporate monitoring trips that Price Waterhouse leads, where they go to Nicaragua and they sit in the office with the Chentex company and they drink coffee and they talk about golf, and the workers are terrified and they walk through the factory and they say to a young woman in her sewing machine, how do you like your job here? And they look up and say, oh, everything's fine, I love it, because they want to keep their jobs. In other words, it flies in the face of reality, and they're in for a big surprise. We're having a press conference tomorrow in Washington, Tuesday morning, and we're going to be putting out some more information.
We're talking to Charlie Kernaghan, who heads up the National Labor Committee, which has exposed the fact that an arm of the Pentagon has been procuring large quantities of clothing from a Nicaraguan factory that the National Labor Committee contends, and the workers who work there say, is a sweatshop. Now, the New York Times did reach the factory manager, Mr. Yin, who said that all of his workers earn at least the minimum wage. He also said that his company treats its workers well, accusing the union of exaggerating problems, insisting only 12 union supporters had been fired, all of them union leaders. And he said they were dismissed legally, asserting it was the union leaders who'd broken the law by calling a one-hour work stoppage and two-day strike without the workers' approval.
Well, why he can speak like that, and this, I want to just make the big point and come back to the specifics. When you're dealing with the U.S. military, and the U.S. military is willing to purchase clothing in a factory, tons of it, 64 tons of clothing in just 3 months in July, August, and September after the workers were fired down the street. When you're dealing with the U.S. military, you have the stamp of approval of the U.S. government. You don't have to care about what you say. We were wondering why Chentex wasn't buckling under to the pressure of the United States Trade Representative into the campaign. But what we have here is one of the largest retailers in the world, the U.S. military, sending a signal all over the world that the U.S. government really doesn't have human rights or worker rights or fair wage standards. In fact, this Army and Air Force Exchange Service, I don't even think it has a code of conduct or terms of engagement for its thousands and tens of thousands of contractors around the world. Anything goes. You can get away with whatever you can get away with. So this person's empowered to speak. I mean, after all, what's words in comparison to $7.3 billion in sales and purchases that the military makes under these conditions in China, Saipan, Bangladesh, you name it? This is just the tip of the iceberg. But what happened at the Chentex factory, the workers, and we'll release this tomorrow, we have all the military documents showing the pricing for their private label jeans. The military actually has private labels, just like any other retailer, Ponytails, Royal Manor, passports. We have the pricing documents out of the factories, and you'll see that workers are paid 17 to 19 cents for every pair of jeans they sold for the U.S. military. Now, the workers are living in absolute misery, like I said, in dirt floor huts. When they asked for an 8-cent wage increase so they could climb out of misery and into poverty, as they describe it, that's when they were cut down. And all 11 union leaders were fired, like I said, and up to 700 workers were fired or forced out of the factory. And we have the names of 150 workers who were fired. Now, the union tried, the workers tried to negotiate with the company. They waited for a year patiently to discuss this wage increase. The company kept saying, oh, we don't have any money, we can't discuss it. Meanwhile, of course, the Taiwanese company's profits are going through the ceiling. Kohl's profits are going through the ceiling. The military's profits, by the way, they made $342 million profit last year. That's going through the ceiling. The workers patiently waited for a year to discuss this 8-cent wage increase, and the company refused to even meet with them, refused to attend binding arbitration, which was called even by the Ministry of Labor. So the workers went on a 50-minute work stoppage on April 27th. They went right back to work, and That's what the company's talking about.
Charlie Kernaghan, we have to wrap up this discussion, and we're moving into the presidential election that has not been determined yet. Does it have any effect on the kind of work that you do, this growing anti-sweatshop movement in this country?
Oh, I think a great deal. George W.'s daddy, when he was in office, the U.S. government was literally funding and subsidizing U.S. companies to flee the United States. They built the free trade zones. In other words, it's everything that flies under the radar screen. It's the U.S. Commerce Department. It's the Labor Department. It's all of those appointments which are going to kill this work. It's going to make it much, much, much tougher. And we're already advising the workers around the world to get ready, you know, buckle down, the repression's on the way.
Charlie Kernaghan, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to get in touch with the National Labor Committee, where can they call?
They can call us at 212, or Manhattan, 212 area code, 242-3002. And this will be one of the themes of our march on Wednesday night, this Wednesday, starting in front of Nike Town.
This is Nike Town in New York City.
Nike Town, New York City at 57th Avenue for the holiday season of conscience, candlelight march and vigil to end child labor and sweatshop abuses.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, and I know that those kind of vigils are taking place around the country in these coming weeks of the holiday season. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, those of you who are tuned in to what's going on in terms of the national election know that Friday was an historic day as the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments on whether the Florida Supreme Court erred in extending the deadline for certifying election results in the state so that hand-counted ballots could be included in the final tally. Lawyers for Bush argued in so doing, the Florida court rewrote the law after the November 7th election. The U.S. Supreme Court justices worked on Saturday, a rare occurrence at the nation's highest court, and an indication that they'll try to expedite action in this historic case. If the court does issue a ruling, it'll be the first on issues affecting an unresolved presidential election. We now go to Marcus Raskin, professor of public policy at George Washington University and co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Raskin. Your response to what happened on Friday, the kinds of arguments presented, and the gist of the Supreme Court justices' questions. Professor Raskin. And we will go to him in just a minute. Also, Democrat Al Gore and Republican George Bush await key rulings today on the fate of thousands of Florida ballots that could determine the outcome of the disputed presidential election. After a grueling two-day hearing in Florida's Leon County Circuit Court in Tallahassee, a Florida judge said he would issue a ruling today on whether hand recounts should proceed in Florida counties where Gore's lawyers argue as many as 14,000 were missed in machine counts. And we're going to go in just a minute to Professor Raskin, but we're going to hear from one of our listeners who sent in a CD, Russ Altman, Punch It Twice, It's All Right.
It ain't no use to vote in Palm Beach County if you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to vote in Palm Beach County, it don't matter anyhow. When you look to the right of your candidate's name, then the hole and the arrow ain't lined up the same. Maybe you're just a little off with your aim. Punch it twice, it's all right.
Russ Altman, Punch It Twice, It's All Right. And you can find out more about this music from Grey Goose at AOL.com. We are joined on the line right now by Professor Marcus Raskin, professor of public policy at George Washington University. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Your response to what happened on Friday in the Supreme Court, where you think it's going?
Well, I have no crystal ball in terms of where it's going, but certain things come to mind which should be paid attention to. And in a way, the name of your program, Democracy Now!, suggested itself to me. The question is, when we say Democracy Now!, is that something that we're attempting to get, or is it the state of the democracy itself at a present moment? If you look at it both ways, what you see is a fight coming out of the Civil War to figure out the meaning of inclusivity. Does everybody get included? And if so, what are the rules for including everybody? Now, when it came to individuals in the 1964-65 period, the Voting Rights Act period, here there was a clear statement that everybody had a right to vote. This could be enforced through Congress, and they had to be reasonable, a reasonable way of doing it. Now, I think that this is in back of a great deal of what's going on in the Supreme Court. How is it possible to, in fact, guarantee voting rights to people, especially where it appears that three things happened? One is where, admittedly, there are questions about the mechanical system that was used. Secondly, where blacks and minorities were involved with the poor machines. And third, whether or not this works, that is the way of thinking about it, works with the notion of what we think democracy is at the present, which means that you have to have, you have to warn people about cutoff dates and that the Supreme Court itself can't act in a discretionary way with regard to the dates, and they can't move the goalposts forward, or as was stated by the attorneys for the state of Florida. So the question is, where does this leave us at the moment? One view, of course, is to argue that the case itself should not be decided because it's an empty act, since the Secretary of State of Florida has already certified the number of votes to Bush, and furthermore, the Florida people and the legislature are about ready to vote to name those electors. So that's one piece of the story. Now, another piece of the story is, did the Supreme Court of Florida have the discretion to move forward the dates for counting? And here I think the answer is probably yes. That is, in terms of what the statutes say, that a court is able to interpret the statutes in a reasonable way, and especially where people's voting rights may be affected. Now, it is a case, of course, that nobody is stating that this is, in fact, a civil rights case. But I believe that beneath it all, that's what's in people's minds, that what is happening here is that blacks and old people are being denied their rights. Now, this is, I would argue, the way it's being understood intuitively by the right. And what I mean by that is that they see that for the last 35 or more years, that they have been fighting a losing battle against those groups that have called for inclusivity in American life. And they're fed up, and they're fighting back. And they do not intend to let Bush lose this election. That's on that side of the coin. On the other side of the coin, Gore's supporters, as he's come to understand more and more, and although he's attempted to deny it, are blacks, women, old people, and now labor people as well. So that is a fantastic divide now in American life, which, if not a civil war, which I don't think it is a very, very profound culture war that any president is going to have to face.
Marcus Raskin, I want to thank you for being with us for that brief analysis. Professor of Public Policy at George Washington University, following up on the historic day, the Supreme Court on Friday, as the Supreme Court works through the weekend dealing with the first time ever dealing with issues affecting an unresolved presidential election. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Texas to hear about a remarkable case of a district attorney who had the election stolen from him. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And today, as we continue to look at the issue of voting, voter fraud, voting irregularities, Juan, this week you had a very interesting piece in the New York Daily News profiling a Texas district attorney who ran into his own problems and actually did something about them. Maybe you could read from the piece.
Yeah, well, I started off saying long before Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris certified Texas Governor George W. Bush the winner of that state's 25 electoral votes, Republicans were already accusing Vice President Al Gore of trying to steal the election. But in Bush's own home state, at least one criminal prosecutor refuses to buy Republican allegations or the Harris certification. Not yet. Juan Guerra is a district attorney of Willacy County, a small southeast Texas agricultural area. And he's an expert of sorts when it comes to voter fraud and drawn-out election challenges. And after losing a 1992 race for district attorney by just 200 votes, Guerra filed a challenge that dragged through the Texas courts for 3 years. And we're going to talk with Juan Guerra, who is now the district attorney, has been now for several years at Willacy County. In Willacy County, and about his own experience with election irregularities and voter fraud, and what he surmised has been the problem not only in his county and in Florida, but in many elections across the United States.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan Guerra.
Yes.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Well, Juan, if you could tell us a little bit in terms of your particular race. In 1992, you had been appointed as a district attorney in Willacy County to succeed a district attorney who had died in office, and then you ran in November of 92 for a full term. At that time, Bill Clinton was running for president for the first time, and he was at the top of the ticket. You were the Democratic nominee. There was no Republican opponent to you. You were running in a county that is about 90% Mexican-American and overwhelmingly Democratic. And somehow on the election day, you ended up losing. Could you explain about the write-in candidate, what happened, and what led to your fight through the courts?
Well, there's a couple of things that just very briefly. One is that I was appointed, and I was just straight out of law school, and I was here back in my hometown where I was when I grew up. And so when the commissioners appointed me, I was very, I guess, naive as to how our system works, and I just thought that elections, I knew very little about it, I just assumed that all we need to do is go out there, campaign, and get people to come and vote for you, and not to worry about the intricates of how actually what goes on behind closed doors, who the election judges are, and all this other stuff that I now know how it works and why it's so important to have the right people in the right places. And in the case of I did not have a Democratic opponent, and so I was in the Democratic ticket. This individual, when the establishment they did not like the way that I was handling my office, they went ahead and brought a write-in candidate. They moved him into town. The law states that he has to be here at least 6 months prior to coming in and signing in and being involved in any election, much less running for district attorney. Somehow they were able to bypass that, and he had only been here less than three months and was still allowed to come in as a write-in. I did not put too much attention as far as a write-in coming in and being able to convince people to write, you know, to write in his name. To my surprise, obviously, there was he ended up having more votes than I did. There was more people that had actually written his name on the ballot, and that kind of got me to start looking as to what happened. As a matter of fact, there was almost a riot that started in the county. There was just hundreds of people that gathered around the court, and they marched from Raymondville all the way to the federal court, which is about 60 miles away. They had a march and marched all the way through the highways, all the way to the federal court. And at that point, what we were asking that we open up the ballot boxes and review the ballots. They hit me with every obstacle they could to keep the ballots from being even opening up the ballot boxes and us to look at the ballots as to how could these people write this other individual's name in there.
Who was the guy? Was he known?
No, he was an unknown. Nobody knew him. They brought him from out of town to an adjacent county.
Now, he was a Mexican-American attorney also, because obviously in a county that is 90% Mexican, if the white establishment and the business people want to have a chance of defeating a strong Mexican-American candidate, they'd have to come up with, in essence, a Mexican-American who's more amenable or more willing to be influenced by the power structure.
Yeah, we interviewed and people came forward, some lawyers from my own county that had been approached by the establishment, and some Anglos including, and they said that they turned them down, saying they did not want to be a plan or a part of any fiasco of this sort, and so that they had to kind of go out there and recruit anybody that they could find. And so that's where they ended up finding this individual.
Now, one of the things that people may not understand, because who don't know South Texas, is, I mean, if people talk about the Deep South in terms of how African Americans are treated in places like Florida or Mississippi, South Texas is a world unto itself, isn't it? Because it's overwhelmingly Mexican in population, but most of the power still rests in the white minority that have their wealth and land.
Right. The major changes have been done in the last, I'd say, in the last 10 years, but up to about 10 years ago, especially here in Willacy, prior to when I got defeated, we did have most of the establishment was Anglo. They control the banks. They control the it's farmed land, so we still have the patron system where they bow to the boss. And of what, you know, we think that it's no longer exists, that still exists very much in this area.
And what turned people against you was, could you tell about the murder trial that you prosecuted in that period before you ran for election?
Well, there was different things as far as what turned the establishment. One of there was a couple of things. One of the things was that I was also, before I got appointed, I was also a high school teacher teaching in my own high school here in Raymondville. And I taught there for 5 years, and when I became the DA, I realized that there was a lot of our kids being thrown out of school, what we call pushed out. We identified about 70 kids in the ages from 11 years old to about 14 years old. And so when the school, I forced them into trying to get those students back to school, the school refused to it. The board members and the superintendent, the school officials, all of them were mostly, about 90% were Anglos, and yet we had 90% Hispanic, but yet the administration was basically Anglo, so that that was already something, the problem there. So I ended up setting up my, opening up a side school in a barn and started teaching those kids because the school did not want them, and that in itself created a lot of problems within the establishment. They brought in the Justice Department from Washington. They were trying to figure out how do I keep saying, I'm not teaching the students, all I'm just doing is babysitting, and the school doesn't want them. So there was a lot of, and at that time when this was going on, we had two high school kids that were Anglo kids that ended up murdering, killing a Hispanic couple for no apparent reason, just for the sake of killing. And so that turned into a racist thing where it between two Anglo kids, prominent business people, very well known. Their parents were very well known farm workers. I mean not farm workers, but farm owners, and that went ahead and shot and killed two young kids that were migrant workers. And so that the investigation, we have a sheriff that's Anglo. Was not doing too much as far as the investigation, and we ended up had to investigate it on my own, and I was able to resolve the case. And even with that information, they still refused to go and arrest the Anglo kids. So I ended up personally having to go to the high school and have them arrested, and I prosecuted those kids, and they ended up getting two life sentences.
You prosecuted them for first-degree murder?
First-degree murder, yes. So I ended up, and that... That in itself, the establishment was not, they were not ready to accept that they had a district attorney that was going to do fair and just of what needed to be done.
And this was when you were the appointed district attorney?
That's when I was the appointed.
And this is how they were getting you back with the voting?
All these things were taking place, but that was kind of like what broke the camel's back.
We're talking to Juan Guerra, who is the district attorney of Willacy County, Texas, who has dealt over the years with the problem of voter fraud. In his first election, when after being appointed to district attorney, he lost to a write-in candidate. Clearly, it wasn't the popular will that he should lose, but those in charge. Now, these were Republicans or Democrats who were in charge?
Well, I was talking to Mr. Gonzalez about it, that we have Democrats that are really under the disguise of being a Democrats, but all their actions show that they're Republicans. They've always had the Republican in this case they would have George Bush out in their yard signs with George Bush, even though they claim themselves to be Democrats. It's just for the sake of surviving. Just now they're coming out and saying we are Republicans, but back then it was disguised under Democrats.
So then you went to court because your poll workers found out that even election judges were how did the fraud take place?
The election judges, only one out of all the election judges was Hispanic. All the election judges were Anglo. Even in prominent Hispanic precincts, the election judges were Anglos. And so my poll watchers, and some of them, even I didn't even have poll watch, but I had clerks that were working there, and they came and told me that they, after the poll had closed, on the paper ballot, the way it was, if you vote straight Democrat, you just put an X, and that would mean that all the people that were Democrat ticket would get the vote, so that you did not have to vote, go down the line, Xing everybody out. But the way the statute read, that if you put in a write-in candidate, the write-in candidate would have his name, one vote for him, and disqualify the vote for that particular office. So what the election judges were doing, they were taking the ballots and writing in the name of the write-in candidate after the election had already closed. And they caught them doing that.
And then you were able to get affidavits from your poll workers, and then these election judges admitted in a court hearing that some of them did this?
They testified in court that they did put the name of the after the polls had closed, and while they were counting the paper ballots, that they themselves wrote in the name of the writing candidate.
And did they go to jail?
No, because they the judge did not even want it for us, even with that information, didn't refuse to open up the ballots so that we could actually have a real good count as to how many of those ballots did she actually signed, or was there, even then, was there enough people that were in other words, what was the number? He refused to open the paper ballots and give me a recount.
So you eventually appealed the court to, the case to the Texas Court of Appeals, and what happened there?
Well, I basically, the first time that we, because the judge went ahead and affirmed and says, no, you don't have the right to open up the ballot boxes and have a recount. That's all I wanted at that time, even with the information of those judges. So the Court of Appeals reversed and sent it back and said, no, you have to open up the ballot boxes, and you have to give the candidate, in this case me, an opportunity to look at all the paper ballots and see if, in fact, that many names with the writing candidate appears.
And in your case, it took, by the time it got to the Texas Court of Appeals, you were asking, in essence, for a hand recount of those ballots.
Right.
And it took, what, over a year for you to get a decision?
It took about a year and a half or so by the time the Court of Appeals, just to send it back and order that the ballot boxes be open and that a new trial be held, and that this time that I'd be allowed to get that information in.
Meanwhile, who is the district attorney? The other person?
The other person would be the district attorney. He was already sworn in.
So then it went back to the lower court again and for a new trial. Now the ballots were open, but then you discovered that the ballots had not been kept securely, right?
Even though we had an order from a court saying that those boxes should remain sealed until everything has been exhausted. When we came back, the ballots were no longer in sealed boxes. As a matter of fact, they were brought in paper bags, in plastic bags, and there was just you could tell that they had been going in and out. I mean, there had been a lot of things being done to them. Hmm. We also found a lot of ballots that were missing and were replaced with ballots from a copy machine. Just totally, I mean, you could tell that they were they were printed in a different in white paper from a copy machine.
So what happened ultimately?
We went ahead, and the judge, they had another judge, visiting judge. The bottom line is that the judge found that Mr. Garza, the opponent, was still the winner, and that there's no he found a lot of discrepancies and a lot of problems, violations of the of laws that they did, but they said that there was no way that he could show that I in fact was the winner, that he went ahead and certified Garza as the winner. So we went ahead and appealed that decision, and the Court of Appeals took another 1.5 years to decide, and finally in December, about a week before the deadline for me to run again, if I wanted to run against my opponent, they came down with a decision saying that they affirmed that the writing candidate was in fact the qualified DA. And so I interpret that as, look, we made a decision and we don't like it, because it was a non-published decision. They were so embarrassed with the decision, the Court of Appeals, that they made a non-published opinion. And people don't understand between a non-published opinion. Non-published opinion, we as attorneys know that when a court is so embarrassed of their decision, they just don't publish it. So the non-published opinion made me realize that what they were saying, look, there's no way that we can reverse this thing. It's been too long. The DA has already prosecuted cases. And if he is disqualified at this juncture, there's going to be too many cases, criminal cases, that are going to be thrown out based on the fact that you did not have a qualified DA in place. So that I ended up a week later, after that decision came down, came in as another time and ran against him. Again, as on the Democratic ticket, and this time I beat him.
So the reality, though, is that here you were, you had been amazingly defeated as the official Democratic Party candidate by a write-in. It took some 3 years for the case to be settled, and this is only in a county where there were 19,000 people and 5,000 votes. So
exactly.
You can imagine where Florida, where there are 6 million people.
Yeah, right, that's major problem.
The other thing, though, is that you learned as a result of all of this, you learned a lot about the problems in elections. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you conclude, whether you think that the situation that happened in Willacy, that's happening in Florida, whether this is an isolated situation or is reveals a systemic problem in elections throughout the United States.
Yeah, after this, what I did is I started learning more about the election system and how it works, and I've learned a lot and tried to simplify it in my own county and the adjacent counties, and we established the voting card that you talk about in your article, the voting assistance card. It's like an ATM card that has your barcode, and it has all the information you need in order to go and vote. It simplifies the electoral process. And it brings it up to date as far as the using computers, using the internet, and using everything available. One of the things that people need to realize that we, in this country, we have a people-run election, and that is totally different than a government-run election, where the government's responsibility is to come in with the best system available, a uniform system, kind of like what Mexico has. We are prohibited from doing a uniform system. Canada, I think, also has a uniform system. We can't do that. We cannot even have a state-run system. It cannot be a uniform system within the state. That power was given to the counties. So each county is runs the election independent of each other counties. So what one system in one county might be in paper ballots, the next county is totally different. You can even be registered in one county and be registered throughout the state, and the other, in other words, the counties would not be able to know that, because this system is not unified or uniform to within every county. And so, and I realize why it's that way, and I'm glad it's that way, because it prevents a national fraud. If you have a unified government-run election, then you can technically be able to steal the election across the country. But if you have each county individually running their own election and being responsible for their own elections, and then it prevents that. But at the same time, the counties are not being explained and told that they need to come up with the best systems.
Juan Guerra, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but you can finish that thought when we come back. District Attorney for Willacy County in Texas. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
vez yo fui casado y me quedé desengañado, porque la mujer que lloras por demás nomás salía de la puerta y la dejaba boca abierta. Se metió el carretero enfrente y el lechero por detrás. Qué feliz es ser soltero, que se amarra el pantalón.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up with Juan Guerra, who is district attorney for Willacy County in Texas, who had an election stolen from him. Juan Guerra, you were just talking about the lessons we have to learn.
The other thing is that people don't understand is that the counties are also prohibit from bringing monies from the outside to help them run their elections. In other words, the whatever county here in Willacy, the only thing we can afford is paper ballots. And if we were wanting to put a better system, and it's going to cost us X amount of monies, we have got to raise that monies through our own taxes. We the state can't come in and start saying, here's X amount of monies, and this is the system that I want you to put in place. Because at that point, it becomes a state-run system or a government-run system. And so that what as the people ourselves, like in this county, we've developed a system which is now the voting assistant card. And then the other counties, if they want to use the system, they can use the system, but it's not a government-enforced system. It's a system that each county and county commissioners are deciding this is the way to go. And we're finding that the voting card that we established here in Willacy, we have no problem. As a matter of fact, the elections run real smoothly. Registering people, the computer checks to make sure they're registered. It checks to make sure they're not purged. So it's just a computerized system that we now have in place that we developed after we did all this research and trying to learn more about elections.
But the point that you made to me also was that you were astounded at the number of times that there are challenges or problems with elections.
Right. When we studied 20 different counties and we tracked down in every county after every election, there's hundreds and hundreds of complaints that end up with the Secretary of State, and each county has their own complaints. But we track those complaints and to see what is it that the Secretary of State does with those complaints. Basically, all those complaints end up in File 13. They're just discarded and thrown away because most of those complaints are complaints that deal with how a county is running the election, but the complaint affects everybody in the county. So if the county has a system that is not too good, that's okay as long as it's messed up for everybody, that it's not distinguishing against a certain person or a certain race.
That's like the argument with the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, right, that everybody had the same butterfly ballot.
Exactly. So that because it was a county decision and it affects everybody, now if they're able to show that it was designed to that they had already researched and knew that this was the effect that they were going to have and they did it for a particular purpose, a particular reason, then you might have a cause of action. But because there's nothing of that sort, only that it was a system that the county decided or the county election administrator at that point decided to go with that type of system, and that's okay. And, you know, it's bad, but it was messed up for everybody. And once you understand the reasons for it, is that we are a people-run election, and that people don't understand the difference between a people-run election and a government-run election. And our Constitution clearly states that power is inherited, as far as elections, is given to the people, not the state and not the government.
So the voter assistance cards that you give out, you give them out from your voter assistance centers?
Right.
And how many states in the country have something like this?
That I know of, none of them have anything like this. I know that five states themselves passed laws saying that you now need a picture ID card when you go vote, that you need an identification.
And Florida is one of those states. Yes.
The problem there that you have is that by forcing the counties to now that they need some sort of identification, a picture ID, the problem is that the government is not given a picture ID. In other words, they're saying you need a photo ID in order to vote, but you take a person like my mother doesn't have a driver license, so how is she able to vote if she does not have a photo ID? Then they say, well, you can go to the Texas DPS here and get an ID card. Yeah, but the state charge is $14 to give you that card. Hmm. So you ended up
with a poll tax.
Basically a poll tax.
Right.
So what we developed is we took the law that was in the book saying this is the type of ID that a person needs to have in order to vote. So we went ahead and designed the card based on that law. And so the card meets all the requirements that the state has imposed on the counties for the person that is going to vote that he needs to present at the voting place. So we're giving them the voting card that they need, and it's free of charge to the public.
I want to thank you for being able to give us your experiences and the attempts that you've made at a very local level. The card is now used in Willacy County, in Cameron County, and in Starr County, right?
Far it's used on this, but we've, like I said, since the card has been sent to the Secretary of State they did notify the election judges that this card qualifies according to the statute. So I know that other counties have already notified us that they want to. Houston has already called us. Even Austin has also shown an interest in using this voting assistant card.
If people want to get in touch with you, Juan Guerra, where can they call?
They have a website. I have a website. It's called votehelp.com.
That's www.votehelp.com.
Right, and that will give them the information as far as the card and all the projects that we've been doing with the card and the history of how we ended up with this card. As far as the phone number, I guess they could call me here at the district attorney's office. You have that number.
That number is?
956-689-2164.
That's 956-689-2164. Juan Guerra, District Attorney of Willacy County, Texas. We want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Manifesto, sung by Victor Jara, one of the victims of the Pinochet coup of September 11th, 1973 in Chile. Well, on Friday, Chile's former dictator, Augusto Pinochet, was placed under house arrest in Chile. A judge ordered the arrest for Pinochet's planning and organizing the deaths and disappearances of 77 unionists and members of the left. They were victims of the Caravan of Death, a military squad that flew around Chile, particularly in the north, in a helicopter in the weeks after the coup. 2 years ago, Pinochet was arrested in London under an international arrest warrant issued by Spanish judge Baltasar Garzon, who sought to extradite him to Spain for trial. But Britain eventually released him, alleging he was too ill to be tried. He was flown to Chile, and now, again, he is under house arrest. Reed Brody is with us, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, who has just returned from Chile. How did this happen, Reed? And were you surprised that, although Britain ruled he was too ill to go through a trial, that Chile has finally arrested him?
Well, certainly none of this would have been even thinkable had Pinochet not been arrested in England. That arrest kind of broke the spell of Pinochet's immunity in Chile. Before that, Pinochet was seemingly covered by a self-amnesty in 1977 that the military granted itself by his status as senator for life with parliamentary immunity. Since the arrest in England, Chilean courts have found creative ways around these bars. For instance, the self-amnesty they ruled didn't cover disappearances, because as long as the bodies were not recovered, these crimes continued past the amnesty date. Similarly, the Chilean Supreme Court, the Chilean courts, and first an appeals court, and then the Supreme Court voted to strip General Pinochet of his immunity. Last August, the Supreme Court ruled. And there are over 100, and I think it's 186 complaints against Pinochet now. And all of them have been investigated by this judge, Juan Guzman. Now, it was widely expected as this investigation continued, there was a tug of war between Pinochet's lawyers and the judge over when he was going to be submitted, when he was going to submit to medical exams. You mentioned that in England it was ruled that he was not fit to stand trial. Well, Judge Guzman last week surprised everybody and went ahead and indicted General Pinochet before these medical exams were taken. And Pinochet's lawyers are now arguing before an appeals court that he shouldn't have been indicted before these medical exams were taken.
Reed Brody, we have Vale Kunzman on the phone with us from Santiago, Chile. She's president of the Association of Former Political Prisoners, who, along with her mother, was a political prisoner in 1975. Vale Kunzman, what role did your group, the Association of Former Political Prisoners, play in the arrest of Pinochet in Chile?
La agrupación de expresos políticos tenemos la responsabilidad de entregar la información sobre lo que fue las violaciones humanas durante el gobierno o la dictadura de Augusto Pinochet. El grupo de personas que ha entregado la información, que le entregó toda la información al juez Garzón en España para poder hacer toda la demanda que permitió detener a Pinochet en Londres y que se estuviera a punto de ser.
Our organization is responsible for handing over all the information as witnesses of the violations that took place in Chile. For instance, many, many of us, thousands of us, submitted information and testimony to Judge Garzón in Spain when he was proceeding against Pinochet to have him arrested.
We're also joined on the phone by Lelia Perez, who was also a former political prisoner. She joins us from Santiago as well. She was imprisoned during the Pinochet dictatorship, 16-year-old student when she was first arrested, and witnessed the torture and disappearance of six people. What does this arrest of Pinochet mean to you, Lelia Perez?
What does Pinochet mean to me? That's the question, because I couldn't listen to you very well.
Yes. That is the question. What does the arrest of Pinochet mean to you?
I'm sorry, but I couldn't hear you. I'm going to change the phone, right?
I'm asking what the I'm just asking what the arrest.
Okay, I'm in the right phone right now.
Hi, Lelia. Thank you. What does the arrest of Pinochet mean to you?
Well, I'm very worried about the future of this situation. Actually, if Pinochet, if Pinochet is in jail in this moment, I mean, he's arrested at home. It doesn't mean that he's going to be condemned by the trial, by the court. So I'm worried about that, because during 10 years of this government, nothing happened about that. It began, Pinochet was prosecuted because he was arrested in Spain, not because of the political decision of this government, So I'm really worried about this. I'm not so happy.
During the years of the Pinochet regime, you were arrested at several different times. The first time, like Victor Jara, the music that we just heard, you were brought to the National Stadium.
I was taken to the Chile Stadium when I was 16 years old. That day I was at school. I was studying there. And after the coup, I wanted to go home, but I couldn't. And I was a very experienced woman of 16 years old, so I thought that we could stop the coup, and we were waiting for information, and we wanted to go to make a demonstration in downtown, and I was arrested because of that. women were raped, all of women we were, and in that condition were raped and tortured with kick, hit, etc. I was put. I was free after that, and I was arrested again in 1975. I was arrested by DINA.
The secret place.
Intelligence
yes.
Group. And I was taken to Villa Grimaldi. It was a secret jail where people were tortured, and all of us were disappeared at that moment. Our family was looking for us everywhere in different jails, in different parts, and they denied that we were arrested. And I was there for 3 months. And that moment I was pregnant. I was expecting a baby. And because of the torture and the kicks and different torture method, I lost my baby.
Lelia Perez, we have to wrap up the program, but our listeners know that we cover the story extensively, and we are going to come back to you as we go through the court proceedings of the former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet, who is now under house arrest. Lelia Perez rested many times under Pinochet. Vali Kunzman, president of the Association of Former Political Prisoners, and Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch. I want to thank you all for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and translated. Terry Allen also. And thank you to Matthew Finch, Errol Maitland, our technical director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.